Warning, this podcast contains heavy spoilers for not just one movie, but entire franchises. We highly recommend going and watching these movies before listening to us as a companion piece that stitches all the timelines into one creepy, crime-ridden story. There will be no more spoiler warnings. We do not break character. After this, there is no turning back. You've been warned. Hit the music.
You are talking about the nonsensical ravings of a lunatic mind.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Hello and welcome to It's Alive Alive Podcast. This is a true crime paranormal interstellar podcast covering unbelievable stories that sound like they were ripped straight from the pages of a Hollywood script. I'm your host, the man of many names, the outlaw Harley Ray, the Bruiser Bronson, Dr. H. George Smokenstein, THC, or you can call me Josh for short. And with me, as always, is my very own Scream Queen, the perfect combination of beauty and brains, the bride of Smokenstein, the India horror expert, the guts and gore, the gorgeous, the sexy Amy Rose.
Hi.
You know what the problem is there? Guts and gore and gorgeous. I put too many G's next to each other. That's why I always nearly stumble. That last line is always like a fucking gamble as to whether I get there or not.
Replace guts and gore.
Yeah.
Replace guts and gore.
Which are the experts of guts and gore?
Why?
And we're back! It took us 2 weeks. Thank fuck we recorded that bonus episode. It was like, here's a bonus episode. And then a couple of days later, I was like, actually, this is just your episode for the week. Sorry, bye. Because we made the mistake of trying to change internet.
But we did.
We moved in here, what, 8 years ago?
About 8 years ago, yeah.
And they promised us fiber power broadband. Now, we live in the country. There goes your phone. We live in the country. And they kept telling us it was there. Then we moved out here. We were told it was coming. And it was always like, you know, it'll be here in a few months, it'll be here in a few months, it'll be here in a few months, it'll be here in a few months. And this has been going on for 8 years.
And then we got it last week.
And finally, they said, yeah, here it is. So we said, fuck it, right, our deal is up anyway, so let's switch, you know, let's get a better deal.
Mm-hmm.
So we switched. And then we paid our bill with Sky, who we were with. We were switching to Air. And then you get an email saying that...
text message first.
Oh, you cancel, yeah. And we paid our bill. And we're supposed to get 30 days. So you get a text message saying what?
Saying to send back the modem and that they're going to send me the prepaid packaging. So they say this for argument's sake was at 11 o'clock. At 10 past 11, I then get an email thanking me for returning the package that has been received.
And our internet went...
off. So then there was an awful panic Monday morning trying to get on it. And you know what she asked me? Why do you want your internet back for 2 weeks? Really?
But what was worse then was, because last time this happened to us, we were like, ah, that's cool, we'll just use our hotspot. And we thought that was grand because, you know, it worked last time, it'd be no hassle. Mm-hmm. What we weren't doing last time was running a podcast. We were not uploading and downloading hundreds of gigabytes of stuff all day, every day. I went through 110 gigabytes of data in like a day or two.
Yeah.
Then you went
jointly. We went through about 240 gigabytes in about 2 days.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know if that's a lot. And then they told us that we were... I've never run out of my unlimited before.
Yep. Yeah. That's when Gomo galanted us and said that we were violating our free usage policy.
but still, in all, on Gomo's website, they're like, you know, like you'd be charged this much for however much you go over the fair usage.
But no, absolutely.
You can't. Yep. You can sign in and you can see your bill and all that. But like, so there's no way to use the internet.
So it was Sunday. We had absolutely nothing. Internet. And then we realized that we had no DVD players. We had no nothing. We had nothing anymore.
We did have a DVD.
We got there eventually. But I mean, this is how bad it got, right? My eldest son, our eldest son, who is 10. Yes, uh-huh. 10. Yeah. He's 10.
Yeah.
And he asked me, is this what it was like in the 90s? I'm like, no, motherfucker, we had television and radio. Yeah. This is not what it was like in the 90s. Is this what it was like for Nan and Grandin? No, they had TV and radio too. We did not realize how dependent we were on Wi-Fi for everything.
Yeah, everything.
We had nothing.
I'm just happy our fridge and stuff wasn't hooked up.
And we saw our one source of entertainment, our shining glory, because I have an Xbox One, this drive is fucked in it. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't work, so we couldn't watch DVDs. So we have hundreds of DVDs from back in the Stone Age still sitting around, and we have no way of watching them. And then we see it in the kitchen, sitting in the corner collecting
Xbox
dust.
Xbox 360.
Oh, the 360 came out. We dusted it off. We got the old Family Guy box sets out.
And Blow.
We watched Blow because we were covering George Young on Real Monsters this week. Big news on Real Monsters coming this weekend on the weekend update. Yeah. We'll get into that then. But yeah, we were saved by the Xbox 360 and we managed to survive an entire night with no internet, no notifications, no social media, no Wi-Fi.
So freeing.
Yep. No, people would be saying, well, that's no excuse for not having an episode up last week. What the hell happened? Where was the episode? Also, while we were in the process of me trying to find it, I had an external disk drive, an old external disk drive, and we plugged it into my laptop to see would it work. It had previously worked in Amy's laptop. Mm-hmm. No problem.
No problem.
My laptop went kaput and just went black and stopped working. And do you know what the problem was? It was Sunday. We had no Google. We couldn't find out what the problem was.
Not because it was Sunday. We had no internet because it was Sunday.
Well, that's what I mean. They're following the story. Yeah. They follow the fact that we had no internet.
It just sounded like Google shuts down at the weekend.
So there we were fucking sitting on our ass going, oh shit, how do we fix this? What the fuck's after happening? And we were afraid to put the disk drive in your laptop after
that's
that.
Not happening.
But all the podcast and stuff was on my laptop. Ah. And it was like, oh shit. We're fucked. And I was like, no, okay, all right. Look, we did a 2.5 hour fucking special last Saturday night. Mm-hmm. I moved it into the Wednesday slot. It's there in the Wednesday slot. It's going to cover for last week. And we are finally back here with the Overlook Part 2. So people have been patiently waiting. But the bonus episode was fun.
It was. It was.
And everything we got to talk about. I haven't actually listened to it in full since because I was there and I had the conversation. I remember most of it.
You know what it sounds like. Huh? You know what it sounds like.
I listened to the end because I remember that we continued talking to him for about another hour and a half
just
afterwards.
To make sure not.
And you had to say it to me the next morning. It was like, before you put that up, at what time did we stop recording? Because I remember us talking about stuff that might not want to be on the episode. I'm like, I checked what happened at the end. But yeah, it's just us getting steadily more drunker. And I mean, PJ was drinking a bottle of vodka. We were drinking whiskey. You know, smoking.
I think I was drunk.
Huh? Oh, we were well on. We were not hammered, like, but we were all.
I was sociable.
It was that kind of conversation where things were just getting louder and louder and louder. So we were just going to be. Well, yeah, if we kept recording for another hour, we'd all be just shouting, go! They're on the house. So while it was coherent, I shut it down. We continued the conversation afterwards. You know, once my brother walked in the room and he started chiming in, it was like, oh shit, we need to shut this down now. Yeah. He's going to start fucking talking it over us and he could say anything and he has no filter and he has no fear of cancellation. They're not going to cancel him from his factory job.
That's Paul getting fired, Josh. Oh, can we do that when we get employees? When we bring them in, if we have to fire them?
I'm afraid
canceled.
You've been cancelled. So we're going, the decision was made that we were going to go to Lepp Castle. What are we now, 2 weeks away from that?
2 weeks. So it's Saturday week.
Huh?
Saturday week.
Oh, so we're going to the most haunted castle, not just in Ireland, but in the entire world.
Yep.
So, but we've been told to go in with no real expectations of seeing anything.
Oh, if I don't meet every single one of those fucking ghosts.
Huh?
If I don't meet every single one of those ghosts.
Oh, but I think it's just the eeriness and the feeling. Yeah, and watching them work as well.
Exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
Seeing all the, putting down all the motion sensor stuff, watching how they pick up on it, watching listening, you know, and getting excited. I think it'll be exciting if something happens and they get excited. Or even if we don't know what's going on and they're excited about it. The fact they're excited about it means something paranormal is happening. And you and me will be like, yay, what's happening?
Oh, that sounds really cute.
Where are we going? But yeah, did he say he wanted to send the two of us to either end of the castle at some point to see what would happen or something? Something about our energy or something, and he was saying
that
about putting you at one end and me at the other end to see what would happen
on our own.
So I don't know.
That'll be
we
fun.
Will see. That would be fun.
I'll try read your mind if you try read mine.
Do you know what's worse? Right. Mm-hmm. I was reading about Lep Castle. And do they have something similar to here to the Grady twins in the Overlook Hotel?
Yeah, they have Charlotte and...
First kid that comes out and asks me to come play with them, I'm gone.
Emily and Charlotte. So I don't know. One of them I think was fine. I think she might have lived a long time and then died and came back as a girl. But then one of the others, either Emily or Charlotte, fell and died when she was younger. And obviously like her legs got broken all. I think it was off a balcony or something in the hospital. But when they're seen... Emily seen like walking, but dragging her broken legs behind her.
See, I want to see that shit so bad. Do I want to see it? That would be just to see something.
There's just something, I don't know what it is about Emily and Charlotte, but their story, it doesn't come across as like they'd be particularly like evil or anything like that.
Well, I mean, the Grady twins were hacked to pieces by their father and placed neatly outside the hotel room. So
I can see
it's
why
the difference between an accident and breaking your legs and having them hacked off by your father.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So they're probably friendlier, nicer ghosts in Lep Castle. You said there's a horny ghost in Lep Castle, right? Did it Red Lady? You said she
didn't say she's horny. She just
walks around all sexy like and
no,
stuff.
No, I didn't. I said she walks around. She was fucking raped apparently, Josh. Never said she walked around sexy. I said she walked around scantily clad.
Isn't that sexy?
Depends on the situation. I mean, if some girl, poor girl, if I've ever heard the
kind of term scantily clad, it's usually been about like some model who's half naked. I've never heard in a rape case she was scantily clad. Not since they used to blame the women for the rapes themselves.
So you admit you have heard it, but just not in a while.
Not in my lifetime.
Oh, I've heard it come out of America in our lifetime.
Yes, wars we have, haven't we? That's fucking shitty.
Yeah. I mean, do you remember, I can't think. All I remember TV is that he's the blondie guy. Yeah, was behind some dumpster in a college and like, literally, that's what the... And this was only a few years ago. And it was like, oh, right, he's from this family, he's from that. I mean, like, she was awful.
This the guy that got, like, he only got a really small portion of time because they said...
He didn't even serve time, I don't think.
They were saying he had a bright future ahead of himself and it was one drunk night, one drunk mistake, and he shouldn't have to suffer with it for the rest of his life.
Obviously, we don't know what that girl's circumstances, but does she have a bright... I mean, like, do you know that could...
Well, so that... Yeah. She's got to live with it for the rest
of her
fucking life.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
He's one little mistake, you know? Well, that's the kind of privileged white America, like, you know? I remember a case like that happening very close to where we live, over in the Stole.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the circumstance. I just remember reading in the paper, and this guy, he basically raped a girl behind a dumpster after a night out.
Mm.
And that was the thing. Again, there was everybody, he was well known. He might have been a DJ or a bouncer, but he was well known to the community. So everybody was coming out in his favor and vouching for him and saying your mom was an awful slut and all this kind of stuff and the way she was dressed
and the fact that
she was that drunk to be taken advantage of behind the thing. Do you know?
it's just fucking mind-blowing. If she's that drunk, you are the person that doesn't fucking touch her.
I remember when I was in my 20s getting so drunk that I had to sit down at the top of my estate and wait to sober up to go back down home because I'd get sick if I moved.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had to fear about anybody coming up fondling me when I was there, sitting there like that. Robbing me, maybe. Fondling me, unlikely. But it's mental, all right, when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to see a bit of that as well today in today's story. A bit of, I think we see that in a lot of our stories. A bit of sexism, a bit of misogyny, looking down on women a little bit.
Yeah.
And we'll see why, because we're going to kind of pick up where we left off last week. Last week we finished up with the Grady massacre, where Grady had spent the entire, he'd spent a few winters at that point over in the Overlook. But he had done it with his friend, Lloyd, the bartender, who had stuck around. And after Lloyd died, and he started, very much like what we said in our Eddie Guerrero, in our Chris Benoit series about his diary to Eddie Guerrero. Grady started doing the same thing, but he was physically speaking to Lloyd as he walked around the Overlook in front of his kids and everything, and claiming there was other guests walking around who were getting upset by his family's behavior. Okay. And that eventually led to him killing his family and then himself.
Okay.
So, so we're going to get into what happened after that. And that is, well, there was a few years, we're going to get into it, where there was a few other caretakers.
Mm-hmm.
But the last caretaker is the one we're going to talk about today, that we're going to focus on today.
Okay.
And that was Jack Torrance and his family. So, born in 1935 to a middle-class Catholic family on the United States East Coast, Jack was the second-born of four children to father Mark and mother Janet Torrance. He had an older brother, Brett, who was born in 1935, a younger brother, Mike, born in 1941, and finally a sister born in 1945. Although Jack's father, Mark Torrance, who was born in 1915, was mentally and physically abusive towards every member of his family throughout Jack's childhood, Jack seemed to have developed a love for the earlier years of their relationship. He saw his father's loud arrivals home as a means to break the silence and would bond with him in spite of the abuse. So, I mean, I think you see this a lot as well, where you might have the abusive parent manipulating the children to make the mother look, you know, to get favor, to get sympathy and for what they're
better parent, doing. Like,
that's one thing when it's psychological, but when it's physical, when you're watching your father come in and beat the living piss out of your mother,
that's psychological as well. You know, it's psychological for the kid, but obviously it's physical for the mother. Like, it.
I was not that, again, to bring up a different podcast. I bring them up fairly often because I do like these two girls, and that's the Murder Most Irish Girls. I listen to their podcast, and every time it gets to a point where I find myself just going, holy fucking shit, that happened here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this story. I'll run through it really quick because this is a real sidebar. I don't know anybody's names. I can't remember what happened. I can't remember much. I just remember the bones of the story.
Okay.
Basically, there was a couple, and your one had, she'd been with another guy, right? Who she had planned to marry.
Okay.
But it didn't work out.
Yeah.
And she was a Buddhist, and your man, he was a musician, he moved away, and she stayed in Ireland. And she ended up marrying this other guy.
Okay.
And a relationship, like we have seen so many times in our country, because you and me have looked at couples like this, and we wonder, why the fuck do you stay together? You got one life, why are you wasting it together when you're not supposed to be together?
Like, yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of case. She was unhappy. He was said to be abusive in the sense of he would hold the money in the family. He would hold the power in the family, but he wasn't working.
Okay.
He'd, there wasn't a lot of physical interaction. Not just sex, but I mean, like, Amy will walk in here at least two or three times a day to me in the kitchen and be like, can I have a hug? You like lots of hugs and lots of cuddles and lots
from,
of
but I haven't said that. Yeah.
From the right people, obviously. I'm some fucking strange fucking hobo comes up and stand. But,
you, the boys. And, yeah,
anyway, but anyway, this woman ends up getting back in contact with the musician.
Mm.
And explain, all her friends say that she did. She became very depressed, very within herself, when she used to be an outgoing person, losing weight, wasn't really talking. And they split up. She tells her man, we're splitting up and going back to my ex, my musician ex.
Mm.
And that's it. This is the way it's going to be. So she said she's going to move out. She's going to leave him with kids and everything. But she moves out. She's in the process of moving out, but she's still living in the house. So she's going back. Your man's in England. She's going back and forth to England to him. He's on the process of moving over. And the husband is devastated. Heartbroken. Like, he didn't know there was a problem. He didn't realize there was a problem. He didn't see a problem with their relationship.
Okay.
And he's broke up. And he tried to win her back. Tried to counsel. It wasn't working. Wasn't going to happen. So he starts going to counseling for himself because he says he feels anger towards her, he hates her, he's doing all this kind of shit. And it seems like this just seems like a story where everyone is at fault. But obviously the murderer is the most person at fault. And the way they told the story in the podcast as well, I actually had sympathy up to the murder for him. It was like I could feel from him. I was like, let alone is this woman after leaving you. Yeah, all right, fair enough. You mightn't have been the best husband. You never physically abused her from what we can tell. But same, then I suppose when you look at it, if she's losing weight and she's depressed, what was he doing with her? There's something like, or not right there.
Yeah.
But anyway, essentially, he was abused towards her. She left him. He was heartbroken. And then she kept kind of, she was still around with this other guy in the process of leaving him.
Okay.
And eventually, the husband snaps. And he claimed in court that he got angry and he wanted to hurt her and make her feel the hurt he was feeling and had no intention of killing her.
Okay.
But he stabs her like 6 or 7 times in front of the children. Oh, the children no. are our age, a kid's age.
No, that's fucking...
And the kids watched it happen. Do you know? Yes. And it's just like,
that
fucking hell. Yeah, that is in Ireland. Yes. Hold on 1 second. I'll give you the... I might be able to give you the name really quick because I actually have Spotify open here. And they are usually high on my... Yeah, here, here. Murder Most Irish. From March 6th. No, they don't say what they talk about. Oh, no, maybe this isn't the episode. Maybe, hang on. Either way, anyway, go check them out. They're really good, but they will be, if you're Irish, you will find yourself being horrified. Yeah. Jean Gilbert was the woman murdered.
Jean Gilbert, why you
by husband
was that?
David Burke. So it's probably in the front fucking page of all the papers.
That's what I'm asking, what year it was.
It's definitely within... There was mobile phones involved, so it was, that's what I was going to say.
Oh, there's mobile... No, I don't know this. Sorry, I thought when you said there was mobile phones.
I just remember one of the points of contention was the husband was pissed off because she gave her son's phone to her lover so that they could stay in contact when he moved to Ireland, because obviously at the time, you didn't have as much roaming. When you came to a different country, you needed a new SIM card.
Yeah,
exactly. But for that full story, check out Murder Most Irish. They are really, really fucking good, but it's they're heavy subjects.
Yeah.
And if you're Irish, they will make you afraid to be living here when you used to think it was nice and safe. But another place that's not nice and safe to live, the Overlook Hotel. Let's get back there.
Okay.
So, even though Jack had a love for his dad, his affection would essentially end at the age of 9 when Mark's treatment towards his wife left her concussed and hospitalized. This was the first but not last time he left Janet Tarnshop hospitalized, and in 1956 she passed away at just 40 years old from severe brain damage that saw her suffer from dementia from the age of 36.
Jesus.
Mark was a raging alcoholic who rarely worked, leaving the Tarnsh boys to pick up the slack. Brett took on the lion's share of the work so that his younger siblings could continue to attend school and hopefully better themselves. But Mike soon dropped out and got a job too, deciding academics was just not for him.
Mm-hmm.
Although times were tough, Jack and Becky, I actually forgot to mention that was his sister's name, Becky. completed school while working odd part-time jobs to ensure they also contributed to the household. After high school graduation, Becky went on to become a secretary, where she worked from 1963 until her marriage to a building contractor in 1967, when she left work to become a homemaker, where she raised 4 of her own kids, living happily till her death until 2020 due to complications with COVID-19. I think this might be the first case we've ever covered where we're having COVID debt in it.
Yep.
Jack graduated high school in 1954, then went on to work as a teacher's assistant before attending college to study high school teaching himself.
Okay.
Took Jack 5 years to complete a 3-year course, but he eventually got there in 1962. In the meantime, Mark's alcoholism only got worse, and in 1958, he died of liver disease, aged only 43. Now, at only 23, Jack Tarnsh was an orphan.
Mm-hmm.
As I said already, Becky passed on in 2020, and Jack's brother Mike lived to be 74, working as a truck mechanic until his death in 2015. Jack's eldest brother Brett died young at 30 in a car crash. He was working 3 jobs at the time and fell off asleep behind the wheel before driving head onto a semi-truck.
So he lost both his parents and his eldest brother, who was his stand-in guardian, essentially, when he was very young. Like, that's a lot of trauma and loss.
I have to affect you, John. Mess with you in a big way, especially with your brother. Then you'd have to assume that if his father is the fuck up and his brother is working 3 jobs to provide for the family, that's the person you're going to look up to. And to die because he was so busy providing for his family that he didn't have time to sleep is absolutely mental.
Absolutely.
So this definitely did affect Jack, actually in a big way. You see, Jack unfortunately took after his father Mark, hitting the bottle at the first sign of stress or inconvenience, claiming it calmed his nerves and eased his stress.
How do you grow up watching your father beat your mother essentially to death, then pick up where he lets off? You think growing up around that, you would give you an aversion to alcohol, or at the very least act as a cautionary tale in moderation?
You think so, wouldn't you? I mean, most friends I had that had alcohol. No, to be honest with you, it goes both ways. I have had friends who've seen their fathers be alcoholics and abusive towards their parents, who refused to touch drink for years or who would rarely drink. And then I have, in our family, alcoholic fathers and sons, you know, mm-hmm. just like something that's passed on, like, you know.
I think it is, sometimes it does come across that there is a gene that's there.
Yeah, I don't know. You see, as I said, Jack lost some love for Papa Torrance when he was 9, and he witnessed him beating his mother to the point where she was hospitalized. But he lost all respect for his mother and pretty much all women when Janet returned home to her husband after the beating. Jack's opinion was that they were weak, meek creatures that needed to be led along by a leash by a man.
Jack should have just moved to Saudi and converted to Islam. It sounds like they're kind of thinking.
This fella shouldn't be allowed to have one wife, let alone many. Let's keep him more Christianized so at least he can just, you know, have a healthy sense of shame and guilt to go along with his crimes. Yep. In 1963, Jack became a teacher of literature at the prestigious New England prep school Stovington Academy. This was a huge chance for Jack. The money was good, the perks were incredible, and the prestige of working for a school held in such high regard would pretty much guarantee Jack would get any teaching job he ever wanted from here on forward. All he had to do was keep his drinking under control and not fuck up.
Bet he fucks up.
Be a shit episode for us if he didn't. But before we get there, let's talk about Jack's wife, Wendy. Meeting Jack at the school debate team tournament, Wendy fell head over heels for Jack almost as soon as she met him. A teacher's assistant for one of the rival schools at the meet, Wendy was enamoured by what she called at the time Jack's passion and fire for the debate and how he seemed to motivate his team between matches. In reality, that passion and fire was whiskey and anger, and the motivation speeches were fear-mongering threats towards the terrified students. Win or you're off the team kind of thing. You were on debate teams, weren't you? Mm. Was it like that? Was it like proper bitchy and cutthroat?
Oh, as in winner, you're off the team.
Well, like, could it be like no. that? Was there ever any intense pressure on you to win? Or was
no, not well, at
what
all.
What about between the other girls? On the team? Like, would you, if someone on your team fucked up, would it be like...
That only ever happened once, and it was in the All-Ireland semi-finals, and she just did not listen to what we were telling her. Because my whole speech had been knocked. Been like one sentence, and all she had to do was say this sentence that we were feeding her in her rebuttal after, like, it was her turn to go up, and she was writing furiously like these big long paragraphs to put in. It's like, you only need one sentence, and then she completely disregarded the whole thing. So it's like, right, so we're like effectively out of 4 speeches, a speech down, because you couldn't say 5 fucking words. And it lost the All-Ireland semi-finals for us.
See,
but having said that, there's politics at play there, definitely.
But that's what I'm talking about. Like, I mean, and in those cases, I feel for her, because there are times where I'm writing as well, and you could write a load. You have this idea in your head, this passionate speech that you can make, but sometimes less is more. And
it's the equivalent of, you had one job. You're the last person to speak. Your job is to back us all up. That's as the last person on a 4-person team. It's your job to, like, back everybody up, shoot down the rest, and kind of, like, reinstill what everybody has just said. Which she didn't fucking do.
So, basically, like, as if we were in... Well, I assume a debate team is very similar to being in a court case. It's like closing arguments.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it
this
depends.
Is what you
there's loads of different kinds of styles. Like, not styles, but layouts. Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway. It was Jack's passion for debating that would eventually see his downfall at Stovington Academy. Before we get into that, let's dig a small bit deeper into Jack and Wendy's early relationship. Wendy, who had grown up in New England all her life, was a slightly shy but outgoing woman when she and Jack first began dating.
If Jack was already an alcoholic at this point, why didn't she see it?
You're Irish and you have to ask me that question. How many people do we know that get away with being a functional alcoholic with the phrase, ah, sure, he's just a bit fond of the drink. And that's all it was to Wendy too. They were young, they were dating, Jack just liked to have a good time, and early on in the relationship, he was the life and soul of the party. Wendy and Jack married in 1970 and welcomed their first and only child, Danny, into the world in 1975, and that's when the party ended.
We've lived through this ourselves, and just like all parents, the Saturday night sessions end when you have a kid. Instead of being tired with a headache from a hangover, it's tired from lack of sleep and headaches from crying and kids and TV and music.
Sure is, mm-hmm. But you have to, there's no other way to do it. You kind of got to get on with it.
Because you love to the little shit.
It drives you insane from time to time. Yeah. There wasn't times where I was fucking hearing Peppa Pig. I had a full head of hair when we first started having kids. Now I'm bald. I was pulling my hair out listening to that shit.
Yeah, you shaved 70%
of it. That's because we stopped the two kids. You ever seen Homer Simpson? He loses the last of his hair when Maggie is announced. So he pulls out a bit every time one's born. So when you announced Riley, the front of my hair went missing. When you announced Fionn, I got the bald island patch missing. And I can grow around it right now if I have to and do a little slick back if I wanted to. But
or a monk kind of hairstyle.
Go pure bald. Actually, yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot they have the opening the top. All I could see was the bowl haircut and the monk, to be honest with you. And then
did they have the opening?
It's the bowl haircut with the
I wonder what that's for.
It is, from what I know, I'm not 100% sure about this. As far as I know, it is very similar to the idea of the letting the light of God shine on their head, directly onto their head. Tell me, am I right?
Let me have a look. Current usage more generally refers to cutting or shaving for monks, devotees, or mystics of any religion as a symbol of their renunciation of worldly fashion and esteem. So it's like, I'm going to fuck up my hair so I don't look
that. I'm going to make myself intentionally ugly to show you how dedicated I am to not getting laid. Is that what you're telling me?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
So like the monks
there's
are all
like, different hairstyles. You had that on the bowl cut with the bald hair, and then you had where they had the bowl brought down a bit more, so it was just like the edge of the bowl cut. Then there was one where you had the front of it and the back of it, but there was like
The Viking guys. I remember all the young Vikings in Vikings.
Oh, that's with the front of it. Yeah, no, this one is you have the front and the back, but it's this part that's missing.
All I can picture is a bunch of monks in a hair salon, and the hairdresser working on one monk, and them stopping every so often going, no. Still too sexy. Anyway, child or no child, Jack's dependence on alcohol had started long ago, and the birth of his child was not enough to keep him away from the bottle. In fact, the stress of fatherhood drove him deeper into addiction. So now he's drinking twice as much, but now instead of being at a party or a bar, he's doing it at home with a tired wife and a screaming kid. Jack's drinking went from fun to depressing to anger over the months after Danny's birth. And as the change in attitude came, he'd look in the mirror and each day he'd see more and more of his dad staring back at him.
So was he becoming abusive towards Wendy and Danny?
Mostly mentally, but there was one physical incident. When I say mostly mental, he would be angry at her, fly off the handle, trash rooms, and generally overreact to small issues. Hmm. He grabbed Wendy and shook her a lot, from what I hear.
Okay.
Made threats, and over the first 5 years in her marriage, turned her into the exact thing he hated the most, a weak, meek, frightened, voiceless woman. The worse he got, the more withdrawn she would become, in turn making Jack detest her even more.
It's a vicious cycle, and Jack is entirely to blame for it.
100%. Jack had tried and failed to give up the booze a few times, not really attempt, but the old I'll cut down excuse, you know. Yeah. I won't drink the hard stuff, but I'll only have a beer after work, that kind of shit. It wasn't until one weekend that saw two incidents occur that put Jack back onto the road to genuine straight and narrow. And this is where the physical abuse comes in. Unable to go to the bars with a family at home, Jack had decided to use his free time as a family man to fulfill his lifelong dream of writing a play. Plus, if he was busy, he'd drink less, or at least stick to cans of beer instead of the hard stuff.
Because it's the type of alcohol that's making you an addict, not the chemical itself. Stupid fucking logic.
Anyway, one night Jack was working on his plate in his home office when he went to use the bathroom and he left his office door open. Danny, meanwhile, was playing in the hall just outside the room. Being a curious young child, Danny went inside his dad's office and started to play with the pages on the desk, tearing and doodling over some of the typed manuscript. Like most kids do, he probably saw his dad doing it, wanted to play, you know, act like his dad. Mm-hmm. I've seen the boys do it, you know, with the microphones and stuff. They'll come in, they want to act like you and stuff like that.
You want to sing a whole song into the microphone. I want to be on.
As Jack re-entered the room, he left out a roar, frightening the young child who accidentally bumped off an open beer can on the desk, drenching the rest of Jack's script in booze. Enraged, Jack grabbed Danny and yanked him from the desk chair, using much more strength than was warranted for the action. Jack accidentally broke Danny's arm in the process.
How did Wendy react?
Livid. And for the first time in a long time, she stood up to Jack, warning him that if the drink didn't go, then she would, and she'd take Danny with her.
Let's go, Wendy. Kick his ass out.
To Jack's credit, he had not intended on hurting the boy, and he was racked with guilt over the situation.
That's not an excuse.
No, not at all. I'm just pointing out it wasn't an intentional escalation from mental to physical violence. The escalation wouldn't happen until the following week and would turn out to be Jack's rock bottom.
And breaking his son's arm wasn't.
He could rationalize it because it wasn't intentional, you know? It was a freak accident in his mind. What he did next, though, was no accident and he couldn't explain it away. As I said before, during his tenure at Stovington, Jack coached the Academy's debate team and was known for being extremely competitive, putting immense pressure on his team of teens and being cutthroat when it came to dropping what he would refer to as the weakest link. One weak link was a student by the name of George Hatfield, who had high hopes for his future and came from a fairly powerful, well-to-do family from the area.
How rich are we talking?
About as rich as that kid that got away with rape that we were talking about earlier on. They donated a few wings to Stovington Academy over the years, with most of the family line being alumni to the school, so it was strong ties.
Yeah.
After Stovington lost out on a chance at the finals in the 78-79 school year tournament due to a fumble by Hatfield, sort of like myself right there, Jesus, Jack would tear into me. Jack immediately dropped them from the team, citing his already overfilled extracurricular calendar as being the reason for the loss on wanting a team member who could dedicate all of his time to Jack's debate team. Hatfield didn't take this news too well, and for the following Monday after lunch, as the students were about to head back to class, George waited behind for the coast to be clear. He was going to slash the tires on Jack's car as revenge. Jack, who had been out for a liquid lunch, for people who don't know what that is, who aren't from Ireland, that's where you just go drinking for lunch, realized he had left some notes in his car and returned to catch young Hatfield red-handed in the act. Going blind with rage, Jack grabbed the 15-year-old by the scruff of the neck and hit him, then fell to the floor with him and continued to punch. He hit Hatfield 3 more times before he realized what he was doing and that a crowd of students were now surrounding him, looking horrifyingly on as this grown adult man beat a child viciously in front of them.
And he fucked it up.
Yes, he did. Indeed. Jack was suspended with pay at first, pending investigation, which took the whole of a week. And after that, Jack was let go.
Of course it only took a week. Like, he was caught dead to rights, multiple witnesses. Plus, what excuse could he possibly give to explain his actions?
Well, when it came to the judge, the excuse was long-term alcoholism. Jack was given a suspended sentence due to his clean record and his willingness to enter a rehabilitation program. The job, unfortunately, though, was gone, along with any prospects of another teaching job in the near future. The well-to-do Hatfields took what little Jack had in a civil case down and out, but on the wagon, Jack vowed to make a fresh start and write the play he'd been planning for years. Not the one that Danny ruined, that was written in a drunken haze and rubbish, but one with his newfound sense of clarity and vision for life. He had lost everything, he was ready to start.
But that's not going to pay the bills or feed the family, so what was he going to do in the meantime to make ends meet while he pursued his writing goals? Like you just said, the Hatfields cleaned him out.
Which brings us right back to where we started. The Overlook Hotel, the winter of 1980.
Patreon is alive.
you kids can't get enough of that blood, guts and gore, then head on over to our Patreon, where for just $5 a month you'll get exclusive access to our true crime show Real Monsters and horrific history tales from Playing with Bones with Amy Rose, along with early access to our minisodes and ad-free access to everything else. All this and loads more horror-tastic extras from the Horrorverse. So what are you waiting for? Permission? Go nick your parents' card today and subscribe now at patreon.com/ It's Alive Alive Pod. Remember, that's It's Alive Alive Podcast, a really, really fake true crime horror podcast. It's Alive Alive, all the guts and gore with none of the guilt. Jack, jobless, penniless, and fresh out of rehab, took to AA to fill his time. He also hoped listening to other recovery stories would help him figure out his own path. It was in AA that he met and was sponsored by a man named Al Shockley, a man who just also happened to be a big stakeholder in the Overlook Hotel. Listening to Jack's story and wanting to help him on his way, he suggested the winter caretaker job to Jack, an empty, dry hotel away from the noise of the outside world. Remember last week I said they had a rule to clear the bar when the hotel shut, when even the stockroom, like everything went. So on the last night of the Overlook season, before leaving to go home, staff would have a huge open bar party.
Okay.
This seclusion would allow Jack to work on his playing silence and would keep him essentially snowed in away and away from the temptation of booze, which would be impossible to reach due to the weather. The Overlook manager, Stuart Ullman, was not overly happy about this, as he felt the job was better suited to a single man, mainly because a single man could only kill himself in an empty hotel, and he did not want a repeat of the Delbert Grady incident.
The Grady family massacre happened in 1975, so who's been doing the job since then?
Well, like I said earlier, it was kind of a case of a different man every year.
Okay.
Single men is Ullman wanted, but each man was shaken by the end of his run and refused to return to take up the post for a second year, forcing them to find someone new year in, year out.
Ullman was looking at this wrong. A single man is no good. They lose their mind from boredom and loneliness, and I understand why he didn't want another family. Like, there should have been a team of four or five people taking care of the place and a better method of communication to the outside world, maybe.
Yeah, but one single man is cheaper than a team, and the communication-wise, they were only able to be, you know, they could go as far as the technology had gone at that point. It's 1980, so they had the best of that, and that was a phone and a CB radio.
Yeah, you know? Sure.
Jack instinctively disliked the hotel manager, Stuart Ullman, and the feeling was mutual. Ullman described the hotel's layout and noted it had hosted presidents and millionaire moguls in its nearly 70-year history under a variety of owners. The winter caretaker must heat the many hotel rooms so the pipes won't freeze, keep the boiler from overheating, and perform small repairs so the winter weather doesn't cause excessive damage. Ullman's description of the hotel and of the Delbert Grady incident only hinted at the massive scope and size of the Overlook and the crushing isolation of the place in the winter. The Grady incident is even more of an abstraction for Jack, to whom the story is only hearsay. Jack doesn't think critically about his own weaknesses and how the isolation of the winter and the Overlook might affect him and his family. Mm-hmm. He's so desperate for this job in the wake of the previous firing, so he's just all too willing to gloss over the possible problems. Already the Overlook was exploiting Jack's weakness to bring him into their service.
Finally, time to get spooky.
Yep. Wild Watson, grandson of the Overlook's founder and current maintenance chief, showed Jack, I nearly call him Jackson for some reason, because I called him Watson. Watson and Jackson, the sons. Showed Jack the boiler room and furnace. He waffled on about the hotel's history, estimating that 40 to 50 people had died in the hotel since it had opened in 1909. He pointed out at the time that Ullman's cheapness would see more bodies added to the pile as the old boiler pressure creeped and needed the valve opened twice by day and once at night, or the whole hotel could be blown sky high. After the tour, Jack made his way back home to Boulder, where he found Danny waiting on the curb for him. Danny congratulated his father instantly and followed up with the question about Jack's new boss. "Well, why don't you like your new boss, Daddy?" was the exact words Wendy claimed he said.
I read about this during the week after we did the first episode on the Overlook, and Wendy claimed Danny was some kind of clairvoyant even, my God. The Shining, I believe he called it. And he claims to see ghosts, talk to the dead, talk telekinetically with others who could shine. And while he said he could feel something was about to happen, he couldn't clearly see the future.
So these special people who could shine could feel the force around them, speak through this power, and at times move things. I believe that's a little thing called the force. And we'll go deeper into that subject at a later date, like maybe the start of May off the top of my head.
Not this again. So people obviously know this already, but to distract Josh away from alien religion talk, The Shining is essentially a psychic, and a psychic is a person who claims to use powers rooted in parapsychology, such as extrasensory perception, to identify information hidden from the normal senses, particularly involving telepathy or clairvoyance, or who performs acts that are apparently inexplicable by natural laws, such as psychokinesis or teleportation. Although many people believe in psychic abilities, the scientific consensus is that there is no proof of the existence of such powers and describes the practice as a pseudoscience.
You think that's enough to make me forget about the Force and the great space gods that will hold the vast universe together? I never stop thinking about the Force or our space god overlords. All hail Emperor Xenu!
What's worse is he's dead serious about every bit of that up until the last line.
You know me well. Fuck you, Scientology. Suck my dick.
So what led to the belief that Daddy Torrance was psychic?
Apparently, he'd often tell Wendy about stuff that was just about to happen, or would tell her stuff he couldn't possibly know, such as how his father had gotten the job at the Overlook and how he didn't get on with his new boss, essentially giving her information that was happening as he said it and was later corroborated by Jack himself. We're about to get deeper into it now because Danny and Wendy's accounts of events are the only ones to go by. Danny's being the more paranormal of the two accounts. He saw a lot more than Wendy because of his, you know, shine. Mm. But Wendy saw some fucked up shit too. The Overlook seemed like they had been thrown a life preserver. Only months earlier, Jack was in the courts, his reputation in tatters, and he wanted out of rehab so bad. Bad enough that Danny could feel it. He said later in his mind he couldn't rationalize what it was alcohol did to men like his father, but when Jack craved a drink, Danny could feel that he wanted what he called the bad thing again, and worried his father might slip off the wagon. But Wendy, who was prepared to leave, agreed to give Jack a chance if he successfully completed the program and stayed clear of booze for good this time. She was skeptical and determined to see her threat through, if need be, for the safety of her son, if for nothing else. But as the days turned to weeks and the weeks to months, Jack continued to stay on the dry, and the relationship between Jack and Wendy improved. Although Jack was easy to irritate and could be impatient at the best of times, the new job, a new sobriety, and new motivation to see his dream true had mellowed him slightly. But as the move date got closer, Jack's impatience and anxiety began to return. And in this time, Danny said he could feel his father's urge for the bad thing intensify. But he stayed the course and kept up with his sponsor, Al, working the program and taking it as it came, one day at a time.
You said that his anxiety was beginning to intensify. So do you think he could feel the spirits drawing him in? I mean, he had been to the Overlook, he'd got the job and the grand tour. So do you think something came home with him, maybe to keep an eye on the hotel's next victim? And make sure he stays sober so that they could get him to the job and feed off his energy.
You really took a lot out of last weekend's interview with a proper little paranormal expert now, aren't you? Short answer is possibly, probably, at least possibly if you believe the history of the hotel and the events we're about to talk about.
Okay.
On the 1st of October, the Torrances took off for the Overlook Hotel. Wendy worried their old-aged VW bug wouldn't make the trip, but Danny knew it would. They admired the beauty of the mountains, but Wendy couldn't help but think about how the mountains could not forgive very many mistakes over the bitter Colorado winter. She thought of the 19th century Donner Party stranded in the Sierra Nevada to the west, forced into cannibalism of the dead to survive.
Oh, the Donner Party is proper fucked up. So the Donner Party, sometimes called the Donner Reed Party, were a group of American pioneers who migrated to California in a wagon train from the Midwest. Delayed by a multitude of mishaps, they spent the winter of 1846 to 1847 snowbound in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. Some of the migrants resorted to cannibalism to survive, primarily eating the bodies of those who had succumbed to starvation, sickness, or extreme cold. But in one case, two Native American guides were deliberately killed for this purpose. The Donner Party originated from Springfield, Illinois, and departed Independence, Missouri, on the Oregon Trail in the spring of 1846, behind many other pioneer families who were attempting to make the same overland trip. The journey west usually took between about 4 to 6 months, but the Donner Party was slowed after electing to follow a new route called the Hastings Cutoff, which bypassed established trails and instead crossed the Rocky Mountains Wasatch Range and the Great Salt Lake Desert in present-day Utah.
For some reason, saying Sasquatch in my head makes that word seem easier. Wasatch.
The desolate and rugged terrain and the difficulties they later encountered while traveling along the Humboldt River in present-day Nevada resulted in the loss of many cattle and wagons, and divisions soon formed within the group. By early November, the migrants had reached the Sierra Nevada, but became trapped by an early heavy snowfall near Truckee Lake, now Donner Lake, high in the mountains. Their food supplies ran dangerously low, and in mid-December even, some of the group set out on foot to obtain help. Rescuers from California attempted to reach the migrants, but the first relief party did not arrive until the middle of February 1847, almost 4 months after the wagon train had become trapped. Of the 87 members of the party, 48 survived the ordeal. Historians have described the episode as one of the most fascinating tragedies in California history and in the entire record of the American westward migration.
87 members and 48 survived. It's almost half. So it seems like it's like the adults each ate one and then the kids had a kid's meal.
Yeah,
half a human each.
Yeah.
How long would you last before you'd be like, fuck it, I'll eat human?
I don't know. I'd like to say a long time.
Amy gets hangry. Yeah, we discussed this on last week's episode.
I get hangry, it's a recent invention.
Oh, I even have it in the script here. It's coming from the girl that inspired the Snickers ads. You know, yourself when you're hungry, the Donners would be encouraging you to eat something.
You make me sound like a fucking gorge or something, Josh. I have my breakfast at 9 o'clock. I run around all day and then I get hangry.
It's
12 hours later when I haven't eaten.
That's what I was going to say. It's the actual opposite. You don't eat enough. So by the time it is time to eat dinner, you are so fucking hungry and so desperate to get to your dinner that you everything around you is an inconvenience that needs to fuck off until you put the food in your mouth.
But is there an instant change once I get that first bite in
instantly.
My mouth? Sometimes when I'm putting stuff on my plate, I can feel myself kind of getting to like a little kind of happy dance that's coming.
It's identical to the Snickers ads. Like where they're angry and then they take one bite of the Snickers and suddenly it's just the regular person again. Anyway, when they arrived at the Overlook, Wendy was breathless at the beauty of the place. The interior reminded her of the hotel where she and Jack honeymooned, and Daddy, on the other hand, looked at the hotel blankly, recognizing this as a place Tony had warned him about in his visions.
Tony?
Oh, yeah. Before Daddy understood his shine, he used to refer to it as Tony. He used his index finger and he would make it go up and down. Like Freddie Prinze and the dog with the head that goes up and down and up and down. He used to make his finger go up and down and up and down. And make this gruff voice and talk kind of like this. Kind of like Stewie Griffin doing a scary voice. But it was his shine he was really feeling and he was just kind of personifying it.
And no one thought to question this.
Number one, his mother fully believed he was a psychic, so what's she gonna do? Number two, he was 5 years old. Lots of little kids have imaginary kids.
Imaginary kids.
Well, they do. They play mom and dad, don't they? Play families.
That's true, they have imaginary kids.
Ha! Win one for me.
Still sound ridiculous.
Jack and Wendy just assumed that he was dealing with the trauma of the recent events on top of being uprooted and moved to a place with no other kids to interact with for another 6 months.
Yeah, I suppose like if you're down for him being a psychic, a talking finger ghost isn't that much of a stretch, really. The talking kids, though. I don't know, the imaginary kids, the talking kids.
Oh, God. But well, you have to assume if it's an imaginary friend, it's going to be a kid.
Have you ever seen Bogus?
Otherwise, we're going into Toby territory, not Tony territory. You remember Toby in our Toby series back?
I remember Toby.
Fucking poltergeist. He was a fully grown adult ghost. He wasn't a nice man. Let's hope that Tony.
Did you have an imaginary friend?
No, but I vaguely remember Dave might have for a very short period of time. Anyway, he used to do it just to piss me off, though. kind of a thing of, oh, you know, we're playing over here, you're not allowed to play with us. You can't see him. He's my, you know, my, I can see him. You can't see him. This kind of shit. Just to annoy the fuck out of me. I never had
an awful shit star.
Wendy said she had envisioned the Overlook cook as a small, rotund, French-accented man, but was surprised to meet Dick Halloran instead. A tall black man with a southern accent. Dick joked with Danny saying, you ain't gonna stay up here all winter, and invited him to join him in Florida jokingly as he greeted Jack and Wendy warmly. Dick took the family on a tour of the kitchens, which were large and intimidating. The only request he had was keep the kitchens clean. He provided an inventory of the pantries, walk-in freezer and refrigerators, giving Wendy the responsibility of keeping track of supplies, again pointing out to her their impending isolation. This is where Dick Halloran gets interesting, because Danny claims that Dick spoke to him that day. Not by traditional means, but by shining. Danny didn't know until that point that there were others like him. Dick again telepathically asks Danny if he'd rather stay in Florida with him, but Danny refused, so Dick instead told him to be wary of the spirits walking the halls of the Overlook and told him not to let them draw him in. That they were only like pictures, and that if he just closed his eyes and counted to 10, by the time he was done, they would be gone again. And in the meantime, Halloran promised to keep his shine on high alert, allowing Danny to be the only, you know, allowing Danny to get his thought through easier.
Almost
like an emergency button.
Yeah.
You could press this and get on to Dick. Mm. Do you know what I would like to know, though? Yeah. Press this button and get some dick. Like, all right. Only with Pornhub. Put in special promo code. It's Alive Alive Pod.
What does that get you?
I don't know. I just hear all the other podcasters do it, so. Maybe we get a sponsorship from Pornhub. Do you know what I would like to know is, if after Dick and Danny had spoken telepathically about him going to Florida again, Danny was like, you know what? You're right. There are a lot of ghosts here. I'm going to go to Florida. Yeah. How the fuck did they explain that to Wendy? You know this old black guy over here? I'm going to go to Florida with him for 6 months. He can stay in this fucked up hotel. Yeah. Dick told Danny, you shine on, boy. Harder than anyone I've ever met in my life. He explained shining is what his grandmother called the knack for reading thoughts or knowing the future. She and Dick shared that trait. Mm. So he went down family line a bit.
Okay.
Dick says a lot of people have a little shine and don't know it, but he had met fewer than a dozen who were aware of their gift. He then asked Danny to kind of test him and says, can you hit me? So Danny, when he says can you hit, he means like, basically,
telepathically.
Talk to me as loud as you can telepathically. So Danny almost knocked Dick unconscious with the message, hi, Dick! I wouldn't mind. Danny confessed to a grateful Dick he had held back a little at the last minute. So that was a louder hi, Dick. in Dick's head. I've never said Dick this many times on this podcast. Danny told Dick he didn't spy on his parents' thoughts because he thought it was dirty to do so. But he did know how they felt. He essentially kind of keep tabs on their emotions rather than their thoughts. He did say if someone was thinking loud enough, he could hear them.
Okay.
I don't know what that fucking means. I don't know, do I think very loudly? But
I was about to say that.
It's just someone shouting in their head. Anyway, does that just mean that whenever anyone's angry, he can hear them? He must think everyone's just constantly pissed off. Because that's the only way I could see being loud in your head, having an argument with someone in your head.
Yeah, actually. Yeah.
Anyway, Dick believed in Danny's powers and visions, which comforted Danny and helped him feel less alone. Better still, Danny now knew there were other people, not many, but more than a few, who had the shine just like him. However, Danny's powers exceeded anything Dick had ever seen or felt in his life. Dick knew even if the things in the hotel couldn't physically hurt Danny, they could damage him in other ways. He told Danny to stay clear of room 217. Perhaps because he suspected the things that resided in the room could physically hurt Danny, but more likely because he knew what was in there and didn't think a 5-year-old should see it. Now, anyone who listened to us 2 weeks ago when we covered part 1 of this show will know that room 217 saw a suicide of, fuck, I can't remember her name. I remember the, there was a Delbert Grady murder suicide inside there. Mm-hmm. There was the original owner is, let's call it pet dog. Choked.
Yeah.
Died in there.
Yeah.
And there was Massey, something Massey, Mrs. Massey, Mrs. Miss Massey, I can't remember her first name, the socialite, who committed suicide in there.
Okay.
So there is a couple of specters around the 217 room.
Mm-hmm.
Dick's refusal to share any specifics about the gruesome scenes he had encountered in the hotel seemed a little misguided in hindsight, though, because although Dick felt uncomfortable revealing such horrific details to a child, he left Danny to face the images of the hotel completely unprepared. Although he felt the strength of Danny shine, Dick seemed to hope against hope the child's innocence might somehow avoid being corrupted by the hotel. He also fucked up by piquing Danny's curiosity about room 217. By forbidding Danny to go in there, he calls Danny's attention to a place he might have otherwise ignored and makes Danny wonder what's in there that he's not supposed to see.
Having kids ourselves, we can tell you, if you tell them not to do it, they will 100% do it as soon as your backs are turned.
Yep, that's the idea of reverse psychology.
So could Danny read anyone or just people with the shine?
Read anyone, I think. Okay. I'm not an expert on this, but I think he could read anybody's mind but only communicate with other shiners.
Okay.
So he could talk into their head, but I'm not sure. Oh, well... we'll get to it later. I suppose he could technically put thoughts in a head.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get to it later when I talk about what Danny actually ends up doing as a career later on.
Okay.
Although Danny vowed to stay out of his parents' head, Dick couldn't help but have a look. He is said to have said that Wendy worried about Jack and his drinking, their safety alone with him for the summer, but that the worry had lessened as he had been doing so well with rehab and AA. Dick's reading of Jack's mind is a little more disturbing because it revealed a psyche surrounded in darkness and secrecy. Jack spent a lot of time rationalizing his actions and deflecting personal responsibility, burying unpleasant feelings and memories.
It seems reasonable if a man such as Jack did have shine that he would try to bury or eliminate that power any way he could. A desire to bury his intuition could explain why Jack's drinking problems were the way they were. For example.
Yeah, maybe like drink so that so people stop screaming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you imagine if you can walk around, you don't realize you have this telepathic power and you can hear a voice
constantly. I think they would have something wrong. Yeah, I would think.
Generally, that's what happens to people. What is it? Bipolar or what's the other one?
Schizophrenia,
where you can hear disembodied voices. That's mm-hmm. what you think will be wrong with you. Mm-hmm. So you would try to medicate in some way, shape or form. After Halloran left, Ullman gave the Torrances the complete tour. They started with the lavish presidential suite where Danny claims he saw blood stains on the walls. Not like fresh blood stains, but he saw the walls bleeding. He remembers Dick's advice and looked away from the scene, suppressing his terror because he didn't want to upset his happy parents. When he looked again on the way out of the suite, the blood was gone. Ullman then shows the Torrances a room where actress Marilyn Monroe and playwright Arthur Miller once stayed. He also shows them another room where author Truman Capote stayed before bringing them to see their own family quarters and new home for the winter.
5 or 6 months alone in the mountains in a luxury hotel, just you, me and the boys, sounds like heaven, to be honest. I put up with the ghosts and would probably be easier than dealing with the living people most of the time, to be honest.
Yeah, well, tell that to the Torrances because they lasted 1 month. Danny was seeing blood on the walls literally on his first day in the hotel and it would only get worse from there. On top of the blood dripping on the walls, Danny claims to have constantly ran into the Grady twins. They'd ask him to come play, but before he could answer, they'd fall apart into little bloody pieces in front of Danny's eyes. Then they would stitch back to normal and skip away down the hall. He said he saw them most often outside room 217. He also claims to have seen a flood of blood flow from the open elevators. The elevators where we said last week that Don Gianelli and his bodyguards were gunned down back in the 60s when the mob ran the Overlook. I feel like I didn't do that justice. I worked so hard on it last week. Don Gianelli. This, along with random roaming guests, meant it's safe to say Danny wasn't lonely around the Overlook. What Danny saw was nothing new to him. He could handle it. He had done this since he was born. So his worry came kind of more from the feeling of what he was getting from Jack and, to a lesser extent, the emotions he was feeling from Wendy. Yeah. Within days of the first snowfall, Jack's mental health began to deteriorate. He had writer's block and he wasn't eating or sleeping, and he was becoming even more irritable than usual.
Writer's block? Like, it's only been a few days. I've watched you spend at least one day every week since we started this podcast just staring at a blank screen. Like, you can see the gears in your head moving, but it's just like you can't find the words or something.
Which is why this show is nearly always late launching every week.
It's internet issues.
It arrives every week, but it never arrives on time. It's arriving on time this week. I know that for a fact because it is now 20 past 12 on Wednesday morning, technically. And it means I will have it edited and up on Wednesday.
Tomorrow.
Today is, well, 20 minutes ago we turned into Wednesday. Uh-huh. So it will be there. We are recording it, so obviously it'll be ready. And like it was like the first time we tried to record it. That first dud time we tried to record it, and then we realized one of the mics were fucking off after about 40 minutes of fucking talking, and I was like,
And then
that was just not long before the internet stopped working, and then the laptop broke down, which led to the Overlook being a week delayed.
And then what's worse is we did record it again last night.
That was for a different
episode. That was for a different episode, but we still fucking, and we had to go through the whole thing of like, I could see your face fall. I was like, oh no.
Because it was such a good fucking intro. We recorded nearly an hour. We were fucking flying it. We hadn't even gotten into George's story. And the next thing here we are, I'm like, oh. Fuck, there's a
they can listen to my audio if they want.
Anymore, it's deleted. Oh. come here. I have so much trouble trying to get me out of your microphone. It is unbelievable. I mean, so they would have heard me. They just would have heard me a lot less. Like, they would have heard me in the background talking, but.
Okay.
Because I gotta like fucking isolate my voice on your track every week and try and get rid of it. And it's so fucking, it's just our sex. Because you do not pick up at all, like, on my mic. And, yeah, even, like, your mic has to be turned up almost full blast. Mine is, like, halfway. It's barely a quarter of the way up. Anyway. In interviews with paranormal and true crime author Stephen King, Danny described how Jack's descent into madness seemed to kick off almost immediately. And that overnight, he began to feel Jack's thirst for the bad thing. And it built to levels that he had not seen since the arm-breaking incident. He's feeling this while seeing and speaking with ghosts around the Overlook. So a lot is going on in young Danny's head. Danny said it really began on their second day at the Overlook. The first full day alone in the building. Jack and Danny were in the basement taking care of the boiler valve when Jack came across an old scrapbook. The scrapbook was a macabre look at the bloody history of the Overlook Hotel, with newspaper clippings, photographs, memos and letters from the Times, all detailing the bloody events there for Jack to read and digest. It was Grady's story, though, that began to play in his mind the most.
Well, the similarities between the two is pretty blatant. Like, both considered themselves to be working stiffs who were lucky enough to work with elite and in turn feed off some of that status. Like, they had delusions of grandeur and they thought they were too good for the hand they were dealt. So they drank and they threw a few tantrums until people stopped paying attention even.
And then they snapped and killed their family. Oh. But it is true for you. I mean, like, Grady worked as a high-end butler for most of his time in England. And then you have Jack, who's coming from a disadvantaged background.
Mm.
And he's working in this high-class academy. And, you know. Obviously, both drinking and both dealing with different kind of types of grief, I suppose. Jack for grief of his life, I suppose, of everything that's happened to him up to that point. And Grady for the grief of his best friend.
Mm. Yeah.
The first major incident to lead to violence was a little under a month into the stay. Jack still hadn't written a word and the boredom was starting to set in for the family.
Yeah, remember now, this is 1980. Like, there's no phones, no tablets, no Wi-Fi, and in bad weather, there was probably no TV signal either. Like, there was no TV signal in bad weather when I was younger. It would be all over the place. Like, you'd want to be well stocked with books before starting that.
That used to drive me bonkers. I was like, when the sun was out, my mom would be like, the sun's out, go up and play. Mm-hmm. And then it would be pissing rain and sky would start fucking up all over the place.
Of course.
And you'd be looking at me like, what's the fucking point in having this? If I don't have a lot of watching is when the weather's bad. And when the weather's bad, it's shaking the fucking aerial outside so hard that I can't watch the TV.
Get yourself a video player.
I paid the Super Nintendo, that's what I did. It was this boredom that led Danny to do the one thing Dick Halloran had told him not to do, and that was to go into room 217. Danny said he could hear a calling him, and one afternoon as he rode the halls in his trike, he noticed the door of 217 was open. Now, if you remember last week, we spoke as well that the people who worked in the Overlook Hotel said that if you stood at the door of 217 and looked directly in, right across the room with the bathroom door, and you could see the bathtub. And then if you said that they used to play a game of standing at the door and staring at the shower curtain, and nearly everyone that did it said that they could see the shower curtain moving, and before they could see what was moving, it could have been the wind or whatever, they'd feel a rush of terror that would force them to run.
Yikes.
Like PJ was talking about the last day from Puka Vogue. When I asked him, was he ever on a, did he ever feel scared or ever feel like running in a situation? He said, never really, but he said he remembered this one point where there was a guy where he could feel like someone was standing nose to nose with him. And he could hear the word run around the building, being said to him around the building, and he just felt this urge and just ran. Like, ran away from the fucking
city. Because
I said, like, you know, I don't know how I'd react, but I'd like to think I'd go towards it to see what was going on, but he said, you know, I think
if you get like a feeling that something's extra like that, or like, yeah, you probably like, oh, I would always trust your intuition. I'm not, and I don't mean paranormal, but as in like, you know, like I'd always go with it.
So people used to say when they stood at door 217 and looked in, if you basically saw it, and I, like I said to you last week as well, if I stared at the curtains long enough,
eventually I'm
going to think it's
more. If I stare at myself in the mirror long enough, I'm going to think it's not me in the mirror anymore, you know?
So, remember now, Danny's 5, and his curiosity was just too much for him to take. So he peeked in the door. There, he said he could see a silhouette of a woman in the bathtub. He said she peeked out at him, then summoned him forward with her finger. Danny said even at 5, he could tell that this was a beautiful lady. But as she got closer, she became more distorted. And when he was finally within arm's reach of the woman, she came back into focus. But the gorgeous lady that had sat there before was gone, and now the bloated, living, dead corpse of Lorraine Massey,
that was her name,
was grabbing at his throat, trying to pull him into the bat with her.
No way. Like, imagine if this is true. It's terrifying.
Yeah. Danny escaped her clutches and ran to find Wendy, but the shock had rendered the boy mute. Instead, he just gripped onto Wendy's shoulder and sobbed as she tried to console the young lad. That's when Wendy saw the marks on his neck. Danny, unable to tell her the true story at the time, stayed silent as Wendy flew into a rage, convinced Jack had snuck booze into the hotel and was drinking again, so she went to confront him. She screamed accusations and threw anything not nailed down at the confused and bewildered Jack. Then she told him she would leave him if he touched Danny again and that he was to stay the fuck away from him.
Poor Jack, imagine what he must have been thinking.
Jack gave it a few minutes, then followed Wendy and Danny back to their apartment, where Wendy apologized to Jack. She told Jack what Danny said really happened and begged him to go check room 217.
Okay.
Upon Jack's return, he said the room was empty and it must have been Danny's overactive imagination. But how does that explain the injuries suffered by Danny? You know? A question Jack didn't seem to have an answer for. It was at this point Danny decided to break his one shining rule, and from that point on, he kept tabs on Jack's thoughts. Not to snoop, but to be prepared for the worst and hopefully use his own shine to try and influence his very troubled father's frame of mind, in turn protecting himself and his mother. You have to realise now, once he looked into Jack's mind, he saw Jack saw something in
that. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So he knows Jack knows.
Well, he had to start keeping tabs on Jack. Like, he knew he was compromised. He went to room 217 and lied about what was in there.
So that's it, like, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just because there was a ghost there when Danny was in there, does it really mean, you know, I mean, like, because he mightn't have been lying. If Danny wasn't able to look into his mind, you could say, right, maybe he wasn't lying, because you could see a ghost, I mightn't be able to see it.
Yeah.
So if Danny went in the room and he has The Shining, he might have seen this, whereas we've said other people have stood at that door and have just seen the curtain, the shower curtain twitch and ran away in fear.
Yeah.
So that's no proof. It's just the fact that Danny says that that was the point where he started looking into Jack's mind to see, and he could see the image of Jack. He claims that Jack kissed the woman. before the woman's image went from being a beautiful young lady to a decaying corpse in his hands. Okay. Like the literally as he was kissing her, he could feel the skin coming off his hands.
Yeah.
This is all coming from Danny Torrance years later when he was talking about it. But yeah, so we'll see. Either way, Danny knew that his father had been lying to them because he saw it. And then to make it worse, this is about the time when he started to notice Jack was going to attend the empty hotel bar where he would drink and talk with Lloyd.
Okay. That's Lloyd Sullivan, the barman that died just before the Grady massacre.
The same, according to Danny, at least. Shortly after that, Grady himself began to show up. Not in the place of the caretaker, but as a bathroom attendant. He told Jack all about how he'd seen his troubles with Wendy and Danny, how they overacted at the silly ghost stories. He told Jack that he himself had the same problem, and that, as I said last week, he had to take some steps to correct the situation. He strongly suggested that Jack do the same before it's too late. He had to keep up appearances after all.
Logically, this is stupid, but paranormally, this is chilling stuff. Like, can you imagine being so delusional that you're drinking imaginary alcohol and talking to imaginary barmen and bathroom attendants? Like, it sounds to me like he's just gone mad.
Sounds to me like a cheap night out.
I was literally not according to it.
See, the thing is, the soul stuck in the Overlook wasn't the issue. It was the ground the hotel sat on that desired revenge. It would feed on weak-minded staff and guests and survive this way each year, throwing in the odd tragedy to pump the energy levels up. But Danny was the one they had been waiting for. His shine was so strong they could feed from him for decades, if not centuries. But Danny was too strong, so the hotel targeted the more fragile Jack instead as a means to attack, kill, and trap Danny's soul and shine in the hotel forevermore.
Creepy.
Huh?
Creepy.
What, did the hotel's after you? What's that, like a vampire hotel? A ghost vampire hotel? Sucking off your soul?
A haunted hotel?
If Colin Robinson was a hotel.
Oh, I don't think he'd be the Overlook. I think he'd be like a really drab hostel.
Or just like a fucking comfort inn or something. Danny and Jack weren't the only two to see paranormal guests. Wendy claimed to have seen a man in a dog costume performing a sexual act on a well-dressed man in one of the rooms while looking for Jack. Realizing they had been disturbed, both men stared from the room at Wendy until fear overtook her and she ran.
So this has to be the ghost of Roger the dog at Horace Derwent. Do you think she was seeing a reenactment of Roger's death?
Possibly. I don't know if this one was in 217. She didn't specify what room she saw it in. But can you imagine that? Thinking you're in an empty building, walking down the fucking hallway and seeing an open door and what appears to be a furry giving head to what appears to be a butler.
Okay, showing them what they were, I don't know.
And not like the modern furries that are, you know, where they try and make... Apparently furries isn't a sexual thing.
It's not, apparently.
And because I was just about to say, furries are very childlike image, they're cartoony in design. She described this as looking horrific.
Okay.
Like a mad dog's face, you know, like underbite, and, like a bulldog or something, but clearly a man in a suit.
Yeah.
No arms with a baseball bat. Good on, Wendy, that's what I'd do too. Wendy made her way to the main reception hall where Jack had set up an office for his writing. She wanted to get Danny, and get the fuck out of there now.
Is the point of the job not that you're stuck up there once the snow hits?
Yeah, but usually you'd have CB radio or the snowmobile as backup.
Usually.
Yeah. The reason Wendy couldn't find Jack in the reception hall was because he was busy with a wrench, smashing the CB radio and taking the spark plugs out of the snowmobile. As Wendy approached Jack's manuscript, she didn't notice him creeping up behind her. Her attention was only drawn to the words written on the script. Same sentence, over and over again. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. paragraph after paragraph, page after page, hundreds of them. All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. Jack then startled Wendy by asking how she liked it so far. Wendy would later go on to say the next few minutes were a blur, but she found herself on the main stairs with Jack approaching her menacingly when she swung the bat, knocking Jack out cold.
Yeah, but again, nowhere to go, and it's month one of what, 5 or 6 months, weather depending? What's she going to do, tie him up and keep him captive all winter?
Yes and no. Wendy did lock Jack into the giant pantry in the kitchen, but she didn't plan on waiting out the winter. She just didn't know yet that Jack had destroyed their only means of communication and sabotaged their only means of escape in the snowmobile.
Do you think at this point the place is haunted, or is it just cabin fever and lack of alcohol that has affected this man? Like, I know a lot of people died in gruesome ways on the property, and I know the Native American background of the location, but Jack did find all these stories in the scrapbook in the basement. Like, is it possible he just lost his mind at imagining a haunting through his madness?
Well, what you're saying is he found a scrapbook and the cabin fever developed these ghosts? Mm. Possibly, definitely. It has always been the big debunker for the Haunted Overlook stories, is the fact that there was this scrapbook, that he did have this information. You know, yeah. Danny would have had this information. Wendy would have had this information. The only thing I will say is Danny and Wendy haven't changed a word of their story in the years afterwards. Wendy, up until her death, fucking stuck to the same story. And Danny, up to his death, kept to the exact same story.
Yeah, okay.
So realizing they're stuck where they are, for the time being at least, Wendy resigned herself to play jailer to Jack and keeping her and Danny safe until the opportunity for a safe escape would present itself. So she prepared a quick meal for all three of them, then made sure the latch was securely on the pantry door and the kitchen was locked up tight for the night before retiring to her apartment with Danny to try and get some rest.
You'd be wrecked after a day like that, but how could you sleep? Like, your husband's gone violent, your whole family are seeing ghosts, and they're stranded until the snow stops, which isn't due to happen for another 5 months at least.
Body just probably crashed. Yeah. Eventually just be like, fuck it. True. Haunt me, God, I don't care anymore.
Okay, it's honesty time. We have a confession to make. We suck at socials. No good at Insta. Can't send a tweet or an X or whatever that super villain looking motherfucker is calling it now. Stick to your space cars, Elon. But we know ye want to chat. You want to be kept updated. You want to be alive all the goddamn time. So we're getting down from the anti-social soapbox and giving this a try. So come chat to us on Insta and Twitter at AliveAlivePod or hit us up by email at itsAliveAlivePod@gmail.com. We want to hear from you. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. This is a project. It's still a work in progress and we just want to give you more what you like and less of what you can't stand. So give us a like, give us a follow. We'll always hit you back and we'll always try to reply to everyone. So come say hi. We don't bite. Well, at least Amy doesn't. And she keeps me well fed, so you got nothing to worry about. Now, back to the show.
It's about 3 a.m. and Wendy is woken by the raspy voice she instantly recognizes as Tony, Danny's imaginary friend. Still groggy, she could see Danny standing at the bedroom door. He was chanting the same word over and over again, getting more and more frantic as he went along. Red rum, red rum, red rum. Wendy said before her eyes focused, she saw the red and panicked, thinking somehow Danny had been attacked and hurt again.
Okay.
Then she saw what it really was, and it was just lipstick. Danny had scrawled the words red rum onto the bedroom door. As his behavior became more frantic, Wendy grabbed her son and held him tight. That's when she saw the reflection of the door in her bedroom mirror. Only now in reverse. The door didn't read red rum anymore. It read murder. At that instant, a banging sound started to come from the door of the hallway. An axe smashed against the wooden panels, and as the first panel popped open, in came Jack's manic, crazed face. Danny said he remembers specifically what Jack said at that point. Just like the popular chat show host show from Johnny Carson, Jack stuck his face through the door and yelled, "Here's Johnny!"
So unoriginal.
Either way, at this point, Wendy slashed at Jack's hand with a knife and sent Danny out the small window in the bathroom they found themselves trapped in. Jack outside, regrouping, about to take another swing at the door.
Still sounds just like the actions of a crazed man.
Yep. Then explain this. Because before we get into this, there's one more thing. How did he get out of the pantry? She had it latched, locked. There was no windows. There was no, it was one way in, one way out. Yeah, the door was not found to be smashed. The latch was just undone. Danny didn't go down and do it. Wendy survived that experience because Jack was distracted by the sound of a snowmobile pulling up to the hotel that left his wife cowering the bathroom and he wanted to go attend to the new issue. So this is why I was saying, explain this when you say he's just a madman.
Yeah.
Going crazy. Because the new issue was Dick Halloran, who Danny claims to have telepathically called from Florida to come help him and his family. Unfortunately, all Dick did was distract Jack because as soon as he entered the hotel, Jack buried the axe he had been using on the bathroom door into Halloran's guts, dropping him on the spot. Which makes me question Dick Halloran shining, because if you can see stuff into the future, buddy, should have seen that one coming. Anyway, meanwhile, Danny had taken off into the Overlook's giant maze, a maze he had become particularly familiar with over the past month, a maze Jack had never set foot in. Danny made his way out and back to Halloran's snowmobile where his mother was waiting for him. They took off for town, leaving Jack and the Overlook behind. Jack was found frozen in place, dead center of the maze, cause of death, acute hypothermia. And before you say any more, there was one cool trick Danny said he did that actually helped confuse Jack, was because of the snow on the floor, he was, instead of running and running and running and running and trying to outrun this grown man, he was smart enough to get down on the ground and recover his snow tracks and leave his footprints off in a different direction and then cover himself up as he went another way. You know, so to put Jack off the scent of where he had gone.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It does sound like a haunted hotel, doesn't it? Like, I mean, there's a lot going on there to be a coincidence. Like, we should go try to stay there sometime.
Would love to, but we can't. It blew up in 2013, taking Danny Torrance with it.
Well, why was he back there in 2013?
Unfortunately, Danny's ordeal had found him succumbing to the family curse. And just like his grandfather and father before him, Danny developed a drinking addiction. For years, he said he had been locking the Overlook spirits away in lock boxes in his head. A trick taught to him post-mortem by Dick Halloran.
So he could see Dick's ghost.
That's what he said. And when Danny sobered up and began to work with his shine instead of against it, he started to connect with more like him. Even becoming a mentor to one girl he felt a particularly strong connection with, Abra Stone. He would later find out that Abra was his half-niece. Jack had had a brief affair with another teaching assistant in Stovington Academy, Sandy Reynolds. She kept the pregnancy hidden from Jack due to his obvious drinking issues and proneness to violence towards children. So she gave birth to Danny's half-sister Lucy Stone and raised her without the knowledge of the Torrances. Abra had inherited a shine to rival that even of Danny's, and the old, now abandoned Overlook Hotel called to her. Danny could feel the boxes in his head begin to shake and crack. He knew soon the spirits would soon be free again. So Danny went to the Overlook, fired up the old boiler and increased the pressure until the building finally exploded into flames, burning to the ground, taking Danny with it. But don't worry, because Danny lives on in Abra's shine, and she claims to still speak to him to this day, the same way Danny claimed to speak to Dick Halloran. She said in his final moments, he confronted the ghost of Jack and found the closure he needed in life. Now he would act as a guide for Abra until it was her turn to take up for Danny and let him rest the way Dick got to rest when Danny took his role. The side of the Overlook remains unused to this day and there are no current plans to rebuild or redevelop the land, more due to its inconvenient location rather than its troubled past. And to this day, strange things still happen on that site. A man by the name of Andrew Pomeroy, an amateur painter, was employed by a magazine to take pictures of the ruins of the hotel and then paint them. Pomeroy disappeared during the assignment. Later on in 2014, his body was found inside the ruins of the hotel. No one has worked out yet just what exactly happened to this man, but he had a look of terror on his face with no signs of injury or illness to explain his death. One more fun note, a lot of this information today comes from the books The Shining and Dr. Sleep by the true crime paranormal author I spoke of earlier, Stephen King. The first book basically chronicles the history of the Overlook and the Grady and Torrance incidents. The second book covers Danny's later life, his fight for sobriety, and how he used his shine prior to his death. So when Danny dried out, he became an orderly at a nursing home slash hospice. And this brings us right back around to you asking the question of, could he get into people's head? Could he put messages into people's head? The home had a residential cat, okay? It was said that any patient that woke up to find a cat at the end of their bed and Danny by their side knew it was time to go. The cat would alert Danny to the patient about to die through the shine. Then Danny would use the shine to take pain and fear away, shining the patient into a deep sleep of death. This earned him the nickname of Dr. Sleep.
Sounds like an angel of death to me. Like, was this shit investigated?
Multiple times. People have witnessed Danny in action, and it's always been 100% legit and above board. So, like, multiple people have witnessed this happening throughout the nursing home. Close eyes were kept on him. Mm. Never any foul play.
Okay.
And that's it. That's the story of the Overlook Hotel, The Shining, and the Torrance family. A wild story, a gory history, strange legacy. The Overlook is probably better off as it is now. An ashy specter, just like the spirits it once held inside its walls.
I enjoyed the story.
Yeah, interesting. Pity we can't go stay there like we're going to go stay at this castle. But I suppose 6 of 1 half dozen the other. We got weird twins. We got crazy ghost ladies.
Mm-hmm. So, we do.
Scantily clad. Just like the bathtub lady, maybe. As long as she doesn't start to cane all over me, I'm cool.
And a red cloth over her face. That makes her kind of creepy.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with a story unlike any we've done before. But I'll say no more. Until then, you know what to do. Follow us on socials at Alive Alive Pod. And check out our Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod. For great shows like our true crime show, Real Monsters, which is... going to have some news about that this week, and Amy's great history podcast Playing With Bones, along with classic episodes of Behind the Mask and early access to Creepy Fast Script and Mini Monsters.
All that, and you get ad free access to our main show and the weekend update, all for just €5 a month. That's on Patreon at It's Alive Alive Pod.
We'll be back next Wednesday with more tales from the horrorverse. It's Alive Alive Podcast, all the guts and gore went under the gills. See you all next time, same Alive Alive time, same horrorverse channel. Okay, love you, bye bye.
Hey lady, love you, bye bye.